Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 871. This is Charlie Hunnam, who, of course, you may know as Jax from Sons of Anarchy, but he is also a delightful individual who is so open and warm, and it just... If you looked at Charlie Hunnam or his performances and you're like, hey, I think I might have a crush on that guy, then I challenge you. But if you didn't do that, then I challenge you to listen to him talk as a person and then not have a crush on him by the time you're done. He's a lovely human being. He's promoting King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, out this Friday, May 12th. This was the Talking with Chris Hardwick episode from last Sunday. This is the extended version on the Nerdist Podcast. And then Jordan Peele is the next guest. That's Sunday, May 14th on AMC at 11, 10 Central. And then, of course, the podcast or the extended version will be on the following week. I know Jordan was just on at the podcast, but it's still worth a listen. Still worth a listen next week. But right now, this is Charlie Hunnam promoting King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, Friday, May 12th on the Nerdist Podcast. Katie, please roll the Talking with Chris Hardwick thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
My guest tonight burst onto the scene as Nathan Maloney in the British version of Queer as Folk. Goofed around as a college student in Judd Apatow's Undeclared, was a pivotal plot point in the Civil War love story Cold Mountain, and stormed our shores piloting Jaegers and stomping kaiju in the blockbuster Pacific Rim. And I think we could probably 100% agree that his role as Jax, the Hamlet of biker gangs in the critically acclaimed series Sons of Anarchy, made us all stand up from our couches and go, oh my God, I love this guy, I love you so much! Charlie, I love you so much! Tonight, we're going to find... Some of you probably did that, for real. Tonight, we're going to find out more about his life and career, as well as his starring role in Guy Ritchie's King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. Spoiler alert, he is King Arthur. That is right, friends. Tonight, the incredible Charlie Hunnam will be talking with Chris Hardwick. All right, we have heard from you on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, using @talking. So I'm going to read your questions, comments, some comments, even showing video messages you sent in for Charlie. And folks in the studio audience, Comic-Con style, will get to stand up and ask their questions. But I'm going to start the chat a little bit first. Please welcome Charlie Hunnam. Thank you for being here, Charlie. Charlie's... You were very gracious and came on the Nerdist Podcast maybe, I don't know, it was like 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah,
and
maybe even 5.
Could have been as long as 5 years ago. And it was one of those ones where, you know, every once in a while, one will just really resonate with people. And then for the forever, people are like, I really love that one with, and you were one of those ones.
That's
people
cool.
really love the chat.
Yeah, I was saying, people have brought that up to me since, too, you know. Sounds like you have a big following, and
well,
I do, too.
You have a big following,
yeah. So those followings met, and we made... Podcast love.
Well, yes. We did make sweet podcast love. Oh, my God. Half the audience just got pregnant. But I think it, you know, I don't see you do a lot of long-form stuff. So I think it was one of those things of like, oh, I don't really know anything about Charlie. And you had so much great stuff to talk about. And we're going to cover a lot of it tonight. But I want to start with King Arthur because my wife and I watched it the other night. And it's fantastic. Guy Ritchie directed King Arthur. And he, of course, is King Arthur. And it's just a really great take on it. It's epic, but it moves, and it has the kind of the Guy Ritchie filter to it. But you guys shot that in the UK. Had you been back for a while?
No, I'd been doing Sons of Anarchy for... We shot it 7 seasons over the course of 8 years, and so I had been trying to also nourish a film career at the same time. So I would shoot the show for 6 months and then try to do a film in my off time. And so that had been keeping me really, really busy, and I had actually... been talking to my girlfriend, really coveting, you know, going and spending a good piece of time and reconnecting with the rhythm of life in England. So my girlfriend and I had actually talked about maybe going to rent a house once the show finished in, once Sons finished, and we were going to go to London, maybe get a house for 6 months and just see what life felt like. And then halfway through the last season of Sons, I got King Arthur. So that took me there for 7 months anyway. So
oh, wow.
It was great. I did that film, and then I did another film called The Lost City of Zed right after, which also we shot in the UK, at least half of it. So I ended up being there for about 10 months.
So you're from Newcastle?
Yes.
Did you get to spend time there?
No, I didn't. You know, most of my family live down south now, and so I used to go up and visit my dad in Newcastle a lot, but he's not there anymore. So, but we shot up in the Highlands of Scotland, which okay. is an area that I spent a lot of time in my youth and one of my favorite places in the world. If you've never been up to there, I would really recommend
it. It's really stunning. I mean, it's just the greenest green you've ever seen in your life.
Yeah.
And the night sky is, it's like a chandelier hanging down. There's so many stars in the sky.
Right.
Were you going to end up there someday, you think, maybe just move out to the Highlands?
I mean, every time I'm up there, I have that fantasy of just going up and, you know, disconnecting from life and living, you know, a little bit more quiet, peaceful life. But I got a few more things I want to do before all of
that. You're still very young. You still have plenty of time before you need to think about going away anywhere. I mean, there's rumors that you have a ranch outside of Los Angeles somewhere? Is that is that true?
No, I got a big mouth. I was doing I was doing a lot of press, I think for Sons, at a time that I was deciding that I was going to go and buy a ranch, and
okay.
I put in an offer, and the offer got accepted. It was actually pretty close to LA, about an hour outside of town, and it was maybe, I think it was maybe like 8.5, 9 acres, something like that, with a bunch of chickens and some donkeys that we were going to inherit and a horse and
nice.
An acre of organic vegetable garden, which basically it was just my paradise, what I've been dreaming of for years. But I had 18 months of work lined up straight.
Got it.
King Arthur being one of them, Lost City of Zed, and then another film that I was scheduled to do that I didn't end up actually going to do to shoot. It fell through. But I realized I was just going to buy this ranch, move my girlfriend there, and then leave for 18 months.
leave her with the chickens and
with the
donkeys.
Chickens, yeah, which seemed like
I got
enormous,
you some friends.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Exactly. So I realized that, you know, timing's everything, and but at that time, it wasn't right. So
just if you don't mind going back a little bit and talking about England and growing up, what is tiny Charlie Hunnam like? What are you like as a kid? Like, what do you want to do? What do you think you can do when you're in England? What do your parents do?
You know, I grew up in Newcastle, like you said, which is. Was a big, important city in the Industrial Revolution. So it's a very beautiful city that when, as it was growing, there was a lot of money being generated in that part of the world. There was shipbuilding, coal mining, a lot of factory work. And then towards the middle of the century, a lot of those industries dried up and the area fell into a period of economic decline. And so when I was growing up there, it was pretty poor. And people were really just going through the motions, trying to survive. And I felt like I was just a weird kid and, you know, grown into a pretty weird adult. But it's a true story. But I just remember one of my earliest and most powerful sort of like original thoughts that I had. There's something that hadn't come across, you know, from my, you know, conversations I'd overheard with teachers or parents or anything. I started to get sort of fixated with this idea that people they were just engaged in the rhythm of life, whether it was like social or environmental responsibilities, being parents or husbands or wives or, you know, that life itself was dictating the rhythm of their life. And there was a lot of people I felt like sort of stuck in that and weren't able to bring forth their intention for what they wanted their life to be.
Right.
And I mean, I'm talking young. I was thinking about this at five and six, you know,
oh, wow.
Just sort of aware that people weren't really happy. And I decided then it sort of begged the question, like, what do I want to do with my life and what is my intention? And I was always really, really involved, interested in film and involved myself in sort of amateur performing arts and stuff. And so that just became this fixation for me from a very young age that I wanted to get out of that part of the world and go and spend my life working in film.
Did you tell your parents this? Were they supportive?
I did. I mean, I did. I was always very vocal about it. I remember it actually sort of felt like full circle when I got King Arthur because Excalibur, John Borman's film Excalibur, was
right.
a very instrumental and important film in my childhood. And I'd watch it over and over again. I remember having conversations with my mom when I was probably maybe 6, 7, 8, something like that, and asking her what are the logistics of filmmaking in terms of I was watching these people, you know, doing this heroic stuff, sword fighting and riding horses and, you know, kissing the pretty girl at the end of the film and all of that. And I said, I was interested in how that would come together. So I asked my mom, what did they do? Did they go out and look for an actor that knows how, that has that skill set, that knows how to sword fight, knows how to ride horses and kiss pretty girls? And she said, no, I don't think so. I think you probably like hire somebody who has the spirit and the, you know, the look and the energy of what they're looking for in that character, and then teach them those skills. Uh-huh. And obviously, as a 7-year-old kid, that just blew my mind that you could be your job learning how to sword fight and ride horses and stuff. So that was, it felt sort of kismet and like a full circle when I actually ended up getting the role of King Arthur, you know, because that role had been one of the big genesis moments of consolidating this dream that I had of being an actor.
Was Guy Ritchie, was he familiar with your work at all, or did they have you?
Yes, unfortunately he was. He had only seen one film that I had done, and he really wasn't a fan of it at all.
Oh, wow.
And nor the work that I had done in it. And so it was funny. I have a bunch of people in common with Guy. Like my manager, for instance, used to represent Guy for years. And so there'd been this connective tissue between us. I'd had a lot of people saying, telling me over the years, like, you know Guy Ritchie? And I would say, no. He said, oh, you kind of remind me of him. Like, you guys are cut from the same cloth, you know, two peas in a pod. And so I felt this sort of connection to him. And I'd obviously, as we all are, I'm a huge fan of his work and had been for years. And so I felt this sort of connection to him. And I just assumed that whenever we met or when our paths inevitably crossed, we were going to be...
It was going to be magic.
Yeah, we were going to be pals. It was going to be magic and everything was going to be great. And then King Arthur came along, and I thought King Arthur, one of my favorite stories and this big instrument thing in my childhood, this important movie in my film, in my childhood, and Guy Ritchie, it just seemed like a match made in heaven. And so my manager, who knows him very well, reached out and said, what do you think about that? And he said, yeah, I think that's a terrible idea.
Oh, no.
I'm not interested at all. And she said, why? And he told her that he'd seen this film and he didn't think I was very good in it. And and so this is all my whole, this whole thing that I'd built up, this fantasy of our you know, first meeting is just crumbling. And it really hurt my feelings.
Oh, no.
And so
no.
It did. I'm not just working
these ladies will beat
you.
The shit out of Guy Ritchie for you.
No, it ends well. He's a lovely man.
Okay, good.
So I decided this was happening while we were shooting the last season of Sons of Anarchy, and we had a hiatus for a week in the middle, right at the time that he was going to meet actors. And so I said, you know what? I'm just going to get on a plane and I'm going to go to England, and I haven't seen my mom for a while. So it'll be nice. I'll go see my family and just get me in a room with him, because I just want an hour to have a cup of tea so we can see who I am. Because
yes.
I felt it was reductive. He just sort of dismissed me, and I said, I'm not having it. So
attractioned him.
Yeah, I failed attractioned him. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so we got I got there, and we sat down in his living room and ended up having a 1-hour long conversation about California medical marijuana.
Oh wow!
And which I know nothing about. He lied. That sort of cemented our friendship, and we liked each other. And then before we knew it, he'd asked me to come in and audition, stay a couple of extra days. So I did some auditions, and he ended up giving me the role. So I'm glad that I took the initiative and got on the plane and went. And
what do you think it was that, I mean, what is it about? Because not everyone would think to do that, you know? I mean, this business, which there's so much rejection and there's so much stonewalling, and you never know why you don't get stuff sometimes. You know, it's like, you know, but something in your brain said, no, I really feel like if I can just get in front of them, it's going to work. So what made you
do
that?
You know what? Honestly, I didn't think that. I thought that ultimately I wasn't going to get the role. I just had concocted this scenario in my mind that we were going to like love each other and be like pals at some point. And then he just completely brushed that aside, and my feelings were hurt. And I just said, you know what? This is bullshit. I know he's going to like me. I'm a very charming guy, you know? So I said, I'm just going to get on a plane. And it wasn't really with the intention of thinking that I was going to secure the role. I just thought I would, you know, make him like me and we might become pals, you know? So,
well, you know, with Sons of Anarchy, you know, that's a show that's a, And Jax is a career-defining role. I mean, like, I know you had done a lot of...
Thank you.
And, I know you had worked a ton up until that, but is that when you really felt things start to click? And at any point, did that role feel constrictive to you because you're like, shit, I don't want to be this guy forever. I want to go on and do other things. I mean, what was the push and pull?
Well, the initial reaction that I had was that it was a profoundly positive and exciting thing, obviously. And that was really my relationship with it all the way through. But it did come at a time that was very important for me to get something
sure.
that I could sink my teeth into. I'd been struggling. We talked about it, I think, last time we spoke. But I've been really struggling in my career in that I had a clear idea of the type of movies I wanted to be doing and the directors that I wanted to be working with. And I was being very exacting in my pursuit of that, you
right.
know, sort of non, malleable in what I was really considering. But it was really difficult, and I was spending enormous periods of time unemployed. I mean, I spent 2.5 years once where I didn't make a single penny, didn't do an hour's work on a set. I had another period of 2 years and another period of 18 months. So you add all those up together, and they were consecutive. I did one film in between each of those periods mm-hmm. of unemployment, and I just felt like, you know, I'm certainly not saying that it's like, you know, woe is me and the life of an actor is hard, because there's people out there that are really struggling.
Sure.
But it, within the context of that, of the profession, it does have some significant challenges. And so I had found myself just endlessly waiting for the phone to ring for, you know, literally week after week, going into months and sometimes years. And I just thought, what am I doing with my life? And I would get really close to, you know, to a project with an actor, with a director I was really excited about and a script that I thought was wonderful. And the director would, I had a few of these instances in a row where the director would fall in love with me and say, he's my guy, but I didn't have any cachet with the financiers or
sure.
the studios, and I didn't end up getting the role because of it. So right before I got Sons, I had this idea of a script that I wanted to write about Vlad the Impaler
yes.
that we discussed on Nerdist at great length. And I just felt like I had to do something to take some control over my career and get, you know, and have a purpose, a specific linear purpose every day when I woke up in the morning. So I had I just finished doing a movie and I had about 18 months worth of money in the bank. I knew if I just ate rice and tuna, cans of tuna, I could survive for 18 months. And I sat down and said, I'm not going to read another script. I'm not going to be an actor for 18 months. I'm going to sit down and take this time and write a script and do something that's creatively fulfilling and that, like, you know, try to approach it from a different angle and create some sense of control. So I wrote that script and ended up managing to sell it and came out of that period and said, okay, now I better return to being an actor and see what's what. And the first script I read after that hiatus was Sons of Anarchy. And it was really because I hadn't read a script in 18 months, so I had a fairly large pile of scripts to read. And I was sort of reluctantly, you know, sort of circling my desk with this big pile. And Sons of Anarchy, because it's a TV script, was way thinner than any of the other scripts. All right, I'll start with that one. And I read it and was just blown away and said, man, I'll do anything to, you know, get me in a room with these guys. I want to try to get this role.
You know, it's so, I find as many in the, like, almost 900 podcast episodes I've done is talking to people and finding out what you just said, which is, you know, when people kind of abandon trying to be something to everyone else and focus on the thing that they care about or, like, what's creatively fulfilling to them, just, and I'm not a mystical person anyway, but something in the universe changes.
Yeah.
And it's almost like other entities recognize that and are kind of drawn to you, and maybe it's because you exude a sense of like, oh, I know what I want, and that's attractive in some way. Do you have a take on that?
I do. Twofold. I mean, there's an amazing Henry David Thoreau quote that I've always loved from Walden. Thoreau is a man who decided to go and try to figure out what the meaning of life was, and he went to he segregated himself from society and went and lived in a cabin on Walden Lake.
Yeah.
And wrote this incredible dissertation about on his theory of the meaning of life from what he'd learned from this period. But there's a quote from that book that always really resonated, where he said, "I have learned this at least by my experiment, that if one advances confidently in the direction of their dreams and endeavors to live the life that they have imagined, they will meet with success, unexpected in common hours." And that idea of the unexpected in common hours, I thought always really has struck me as has got a great amount of truth to it, because The other thing that I read an interesting book a while ago called, I think, The Seven Rings or The Five Rings, and it was about a samurai, and he talks a lot about the sacrifices that the samurai would make to their sword. Everything is about the relationship with their sword, and no sacrifice is too great to make to that sword, because you make all of that sacrifice with the agreement that in the moments, whether it would be 1 second or 3 minutes, every 10 years, you're going to need that sword to save your life.
And it'll be there for you.
And it'll be there for you.
Right.
And so I've often thought about that, that, you know, you put in 40% effort, you get 40% results. You put in 80% effort, you get 80% results. But if you put 100% effort in, somehow the universe conspires to help you, and you'll get 120% result, you know? And so none of that was particularly linear, what I just said.
No,
but it was all circling around the same idea.
It all makes sense because it does help explain. I mean, again, you know, everyone runs off in a million different directions. Oh, my God, if you're auditioning, oh, I want this person to like me, and this person, oh, they didn't, oh, no, I got so close, you know, or whatever it is that people are pursuing. And there really is, you know, like when you just kind of let all that crap go and just go, well, what do I want? You know, what makes me happy? Which is a question I think a lot of people don't really even know how to answer or even bother asking themselves.
Yeah.
But I think it is one of the single most important questions to be able to answer as a human.
Right.
And people just don't take the time to do it. And I've always been impressed with, because it seems like you just work on stuff that you're interested in and cool stuff. And then when the whole 50 Shades thing happened and they cash in 50 Shades, like, oh, you know, Charlie's a good guy. That's going to be a big franchise. And then it all kind of went away. And then I don't know. I had a lot of respect for, I don't know, it just like to kind of walk away from something like that you knew was probably going to be a commercial success, but maybe just didn't feel right to you. Is that how it went down, or what was the?
I mean, with that specifically, there were many moving elements to that. I got myself in a position because I was emotionally in a bit of a wrought place that had a big thing happen in my life, my personal life, and it had thrown me for a spiral, you know? And so I don't think I was thinking clearly. And I was in a great position in my career where for the first time I was getting offered tons of interesting stuff. And I've always felt very strongly, just do one thing at a time and do it to the best of your ability. But then all of a sudden, in the face of all of this opportunity that was coming my way, it was a little harder to practice what I was preaching.
Sure.
And I just took on too much and felt like not only it takes an enormous amount of focus and energy to make a movie and be a significant part of that process. And I felt like everybody needs to give it their all to make sure this collective, you know, process bears the fruits that you would hope it to. And I just felt like I was spreading myself too thin. And I'd already given my word to Guillermo del Toro, who was a friend of mine I'd worked with before, that I would star in this other movie. And that had preceded the 50 Shades. So it was very, it was really quite unfortunate and quite stressful because I accepted the role, and they publicized it to pretty robustly. And then all of a sudden, I realized that I wasn't going to be able to do it. So
just kidding.
Yeah, a little bit. So it was a rather stressful period of my life, but you live and learn, as they say.
Yeah, but I think it's a smart thing to be able to do, to realize when you're spreading yourself too thin, because, you know, especially with what we do, it's like, well, I don't know if I'm going to work again. You take work because you go, this is kind of, we gather these acorns.
Right.
If there are lean times, you want to appreciate the work that you get. So to kind of let something go because you feel like it's too much is, it's a good decision, but it's not a decision everyone would make.
Right. But I think also having integrity in being authentic and true to yourself, sort of circling sure. back to your initial conversation point, I think is essential, you know, because ultimately, you know, it's a hard business, and ultimately it is a business, and there's always a tendency or an emphasis put on one's momentum and cachet in the business right. at large. And so something like that comes up, and for sure, I think it was just a given. I don't think anybody had any doubt in their mind that it was going to come out and be an enormous financial success. But at the center of it, I had to question if that was leading the motivation to say yes and be involved in that as much as like a creative decision.
I mean, I think you maybe dodged a little bit of a bullet.
You know what? To be fair, you know, I got to.
Let's just be honest.
I don't know. I got to like and admire all of the people involved in that film because I was in it, and so I was interacting with these people.
Had you already started rehearsals and everything, or was
no?
It?
But there'd been a long gotcha. Process of chemistry readings sure. and stuff, and so I got to know Dakota very well, and I got to know Sam, the director, very very well, and got to really care about her as a pal, and so you know it was. Funny because I was just I never wanted to have an opinion about it, so I never saw the films. So you know, and anytime anyone talks about it, I sort of just sure. tune it out a little bit because
right.
I had nothing but the regret for the way I, you know, for the difficulty that I had created for those people when
yeah.
I pulled out, and you know, and hope that it would be very successful for them. So
well, listen, you know, it's
and
it's,
I think it has been right.
It's
I mean,
been very,
it made
listen,
an
you know,
enormous amount of
there's
money.
Nothing wrong with Twilight for MILFs. Like, there's nothing wrong with it. It's a different. You know, everyone deserves a movie. Every audience deserves a movie. Every audience deserves a movie.
Do you guys like the movie? okay. All right, moving on.
But it allows you to make cool stuff like, you know, like King Arthur or Lost City. You say Lost City of Zed, but we say Z here in the United States. But you mean, is it Z here? Are they saying Lost City of Z here?
I think they're saying Z.
Lost City of Z yeah. here?
I mean, you could make an argument that, you know, America speaks English, which was obviously created in England, so maybe
yeah.
Zed
should
gonna,
be the
like,
correct
split
way.
As might yeah. be the correct pronunciation,
yeah.
but...
Yeah. I mean,
I am no one to talk because I go to England now and people think I'm American. So.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, okay, so that's kind of an interesting question. Does that affect, I mean, your identity being this, you know, you're here and you're there. Do you, I know you identify as British, but do you identify as American at all? Like, when you go back, do you feel like a little bit of an outsider?
I do, a little bit. And it's so funny, geographical identity, because it doesn't really ultimately mean anything,
right.
but it is... People are incredibly passionate about their geographical identity and the identity of dialect, particularly in England, which is so small but has such heightened, very, very specific regional dialects everywhere, you know? So I had already sort of gone through a couple of experiences of understanding how vilified you can be for surrendering a specific identity and
sure.
taking another one on, because I had moved to from Newcastle to the Lake District, which is two very, very different dialects, at a time when I was impressionable, young, and just wanted to fit in. I moved when I think I was about 13. It was very difficult to move, you know, 200 miles to go to a new school and a whole new friends and everything at that age. So one of the things that I think I did was, one of the ways I tried to fit in was by assimilating that accent.
Oh, wow. Know?
And then going home immediately, like 6 months later, and all my old pals being like, oh, you're fucking talking different now, aren't you? Like, you're too good for us. And like, wow, people are really passionate about their regional identity.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of tribalism
yeah.
in a very small area, it seems like.
Yeah.
Because in America, I think we kind of understand, like, well, America's very large, so, you know, the Midwest is this and South is this and Texas is its own thing and then New York is this. But there, I mean, you know, you have a landmass about the size of California, but with that much specific subset genre cultural diversity.
Right.
So do you feel like that helped you in this business at all, in the assimilation process? Does that help you as an actor?
I think so. I mean, it would seem so, right?
Yeah.
Like on the surface, just that like thing of being able to, you know, pick up accents and all of that. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure it did. I'm sure it did. It certainly made me fearless about coming out here when I was 18 alone. I mean,
right.
I didn't know anybody when I came to LA. I was at college studying film and got an opportunity to start working as an actor. So I took this role in Queer as Folk that you had mentioned. And then once I finished that, I was sort of at a crossroads. I could go back to film school, but I realized I'd been at film school for about a year and realized I'd learned more on my first day on a real set than I had in 12 months of academic, you know, research
at right.
what filmmaking is. And so the practical application. And so I didn't know what to do, though. I finished this TV show and was really literally about to go back and move back in with my mom and continue going to college. And I got a call from someone saying they'd seen the show, a manager from Los Angeles, that they'd seen the show and thought that I was good and wondered if I would like representation and like to come out here and, you know, go seek my fortune. So I just came out at 18 by myself, and you know, I think had I not had that experience of having to completely reinvent myself and start over in my mid-teens, it might have been a bit more daunting to do that.
I mean, we don't know each other that well, but I just have a sense that, I don't know, do you feel as confident as it seems you are? Like, it seems like, Charlie seems like a guy you could just drop him into anything and he'll fucking figure it out. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like I could drop you in the middle of the wilderness and you'd go, okay, yeah, okay, I gotta use that snake as a ladder and I'll cut down that tree and I'll make a fire with my fists. Like, how, does the world feel like that to you? Do you feel
no,
like, it
the
doesn't.
Opposite.
Really?
The absolute opposite. Yeah, I feel sort of, you know, like I've got my neuroses and my, you know, my things that I, you know, worry about and feel inadequate and, you know, like everybody else all the time. I mean, I'm here. I got very nervous about coming here. I was
really?
Driving over and I hadn't talked about the film or done any interviews. And this is sort of, you know, it's not a natural thing to be doing, sitting and talking in front of, you know, very lovely people, but none of you I know at all and having a conversation like this. I mean, you do it day in, day out, but it takes a certain amount of focus and energy to do this. And I just came back from vacation where I'd been thinking about nothing. So and nothing but what I was going to eat for lunch. And
while I was in King Arthur? What?
Right. Yeah, no, it was
King
a little
Arthur,
bit like that.
King
I thought,
Arthur.
Oh, my goodness, I'm going to actually have to go and string a sentence together here and try to maybe tell a couple of jokes. So.
Oh, my God, yeah. Well, wait till you get into junket mode, and then you have to like, answer the same five fucking questions over and over and over and over and over again.
Yeah.
But I definitely want to get some general questions from the audience because this is partially why we're here. Oh, wow. This is Romanda Tidball on Twitter. Hi, Charlie. Would you play James Bond if you were offered the role? oh, this lady who has just decided to be your agent has said yes.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that. I'm actually talking to somebody about a spy genre film set in America that we're all very, very excited about. I feel like Daniel Craig's doing a great job and whoever else.
Yeah.
That goes down to that identity thing. I mean, I know I'm playing King Arthur, but you can almost get away with King Arthur easier than you can
get
away
with. Well, there's not going to be like 9 King Arthur movies.
You never know.
I guess there could
you
be.
You never know.
I guess there could be. Yeah, but it is like, how do you pull away from that kind of indelible, you know, because I would imagine you probably want to, there must be an allure of like, oh, it's such an iconic role. But at the same time, do I want to do that for, you know, a decade?
Right. Well, listen, they haven't asked me, so I don't need to worry about it.
This It's My Life 87. What is your pet peeve?
I'm a total germaphobe. And so I really hate having to shake hands. Yeah.
I wish you had told me that before I shook your hand when you got here.
No, I initiated.
Okay, that's true.
Because I understand that in some situations it's, you know, it's the thing to do. But
yeah.
I was at a restaurant the other day eating some curry with bread. And it was like getting right in there with my hands. And a guy came over, really, really sweet guy who just was a big fan of Sons and wanted to just come over and say hello and shake my hand. But, you know, sometimes when somebody and it happens to me too. There's somebody that you watch on TV or that you admire in some way, and you meet them, you get a little nervous. And I don't know about you guys, but sometimes my hands get a little sweaty when I'm nervous. And this guy suffered from that same affliction. So, I had a little sweaty handshake right in the middle of eating my meal. So that
then the rest of the time you're just trying to eat with.
Yeah,
the other
I was.
Hand.
I ate. I said, all right, I guess I'm gonna have to get a fork and just use this hand.
Because you don't want to be rude, and then the second he walks away, you're doing this, and he turns around and like, oh, hi. I didn't mean to wipe your essence off my hand.
Right.
What's the weirdest thing that Ed Van has said or done to you?
I got a letter a while ago from a lady in Italy, and it was very, very straightforward. You sort of basic, like, really like you, think you're great, would like to meet you sometime. But if that doesn't happen, is there any chance you could send me a lock of hair or one of your fingernails?
I mean,
and then she said, you may think that this sounds fetishistic, and you would be right. So I sent her some fingernails.
Did you really?
No.
Oh,
are you
crazy?
That'd be
amazing.
No. No. So that was an unusual one.
Do fans ever give you career advice? Because I find sometimes just being, you know, in juxtaposition of The Walking Dead, like people will come up and they'll, like, they talk at the actors like, how could you do that? Mm-hmm. You know? Do people, because they, you know, people do have that kind of an ownership over, I think, over their fandoms, you know? It's like they let the show into their homes, it's very intimate to them, they connect to it, and so they sort of watch it like it's a documentary.
Right.
So they probably do feel some sense of ownership over you, so do people just kind of come up and go, you know what you ought to do?
Yeah, that happens. That happens. I don't know why, this doesn't really answer your question, but what came into my mind when you were saying that is I was doing another film, and I was playing a guy coming out of prison, and I wanted to go and visit a prison just to sort of feel what that rhythm was like. So I got invited to go to Ayman prison.
So I thought you were going to say, so I got arrested.
So I got arrested, yeah, sure. No, I went and visited this prison, which is a supermax prison in Arizona called Ayman, and it's heavy. Like, the vibe in there was really, really serious. And there'd just been a stabbing in this main hall right before, and so they'd cleared it out. And then we went into this giant hall, and it was like an old-school prison with, four levels and, like, the metal bars all the way along and everyone looking in. And the warden had such an enormous amount of power. And, like, these dudes were, like, serious, you know, contenders. Like,
right.
These were tough guys.
Real deal, no joke.
Real deal, all like in maximum security, serving, you know, long sentences. And we walked in, it was really rowdy, and just the energy hit us. And I was like, man, this is probably not the smartest place to be. And then this hush fell over the whole place. And I heard one girl like, yo, big dog's here. And they were talking about the warden. And it was just, was clear the enormous amount of power that this guy had in that environment. And then it was all, like, very, very quiet for a second. And I just felt like all of this intention was on us. And I never wanted to feel more, like, anonymous. And then someone screamed, yo, Jax, we're able at, homie. And I realized, oh. All of these people know me. And so it was ended up being cool. And I walked around, had some conversations with people. But it doesn't really answer your question, but it was kind of a sweet moment.
But it is one of those moments where, you know, because there are times when I'm sure you don't want to be recognized, you know, if you're having a bad day or if you're having... But certainly in a maximum security prison, you want people to be fans.
That's where you want it.
We have to take a quick break. When we come back, our audience member is going to get up and ask questions of Charlie Hunnam, who is here. Also questions from you guys at home. And if you want to be a part of the show, we're at Talking on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You're going to find exclusive updates about upcoming guests and ask questions that you have for these guests. Because no matter who we're talking to, you are part of the conversation. More with Charlie Hunnam when we come back on Talking with Chris Hardwick. Welcome back to Talking with Chris Hardwick. Hi, Chris Hardwick. Charlie Hunter is my guest. Now it's time to have a very nice fan from the audience get up and ask a question. Please stand up and ask your question. Hello.
Hello. How are you doing?
What's your name?
My name is Mark. I'm from San Pedro.
Wait, I'm sorry, what was it?
Mark from San Pedro.
Hey, Mark, what is your question?
My question is for Charlie.
What type
of sword training did you do for King Arthur? And was there any mishaps?
Not any hilarious or significant mishaps, and a million small knocks to the, mainly on the hands, on the knuckles, you know, that cumulatively end up with a sore hand at the end of a long day of sword fighting. But I know people always say it, those, whether it's fist fighting or sword fighting or staff fighting for film is always much more like a dance, you know? It's like you just learn a couple of those moves, you very specifically choreographed, and then you do a couple more and you do a couple more and then put the whole thing together. So it's not as scary or exciting or fun as it might be. I heard that Russell Crowe, I mean, this is just pure gossip, but why not? I heard that Russell Crowe on Gladiator used to go off book in terms of the choreography and would just start swinging
that
the sword
around.
That sounds
about right. Yeah, that tracks. So, I don't think anyone here is surprised to hear that.
Yeah, no, after a while, you know, he was just working with
probably
stunt
even
guys.
When the cameras weren't even rolling.
Yeah, right.
He was still yeah. swinging a sword. And even the fact that I'm saying that and making jokes about it, he's right. probably going to attack me
yeah,
with
Yeah, you
sword.
Better not have him on the show.
You know, I have a very special gift for you. These pants and these boots. Cut that part out. All right. Mark, I have a very special gift for you. Mark, would you like to pull the sword out of the...
All right.
I think whosoever pulls this sword from the stone shall henceforth be king of all England.
I better oversee this.
Yeah.
See what my competition looks like.
Mark is the king! That, you can keep that. Charlie assigned that.
Thank you very much. Well done, go. Sir.
Nice to see you. Oh, he just said he didn't like shaking hands, Mark!
Oh.
He just said, yes, yes, yes. Oh, my gosh. You know, Charlie, Mark looks, he's clean.
Yeah,
you don't have to worry about
I'm
it.
I'm not worried about
he's,
him.
He's all washed. Next, we have a video message for a fan for Charlie, from a fan for Charlie. Let's take a look.
Hi, my name is Amy. I'm from Hoboken, New Jersey. I'm a big Sons of Anarchy fan, and I was wondering if you're scared of ever being typecast as the tough guy.
Are you scared of ever being typecast as the tough guy?
I'm so lovely. So clearly so lovely and gentle. I guess not. No. I love playing tough guys, though, so I seem to gravitate towards those roles, but I never really worry about sort of being typecast, just probably because my mom tells me how lovely I am
on
such
good.
A
yeah.
regular basis.
That's
that,
nice.
Yeah,
you're a nice boy.
Mitigates any fear in that department.
Did you were you a tough kid growing up, or did you or do you?
There were times where I had to be, but no. I mean, I was actually really scared most of the time. I grew up in a place where dudes loved to fight, and there was a lot of fighting all the time. It was a real currency in this little town that I grew up with in my teenage years called Penrith in the Lake District. And there was, I didn't really fit in that well, or despite my best efforts initially, and then I decided, fuck it, I'm not even going to try after
right,
a while.
Right.
And was just like the weird kid in town. And so I definitely found myself in situations pretty regularly where there was either the threat of having to fight or I actually did have to.
Sure.
And I hated it, you know? And it was funny, like I grew up, my dad's like was a super, super tough dude. And I always sort of had trouble reconciling the fear that I had in the face of violence when yeah. he was a dude who had really excelled in an industry, not an illegal industry, a legal industry, but that was often very self-policed. Mm-hmm. He was a scrap man, and those guys, there's a lot of theft in that business, and because there's a lot of theft and the actual metal that they're trading is very valuable, it then becomes cost prohibitive to be able to insure. And so it's like one of those like legal businesses that ends up being self-policed, where you have to have the reputation to back you up, that people know if they mess around, come steal your shit, it's going to be a bad day for them,
right.
you know? And so my dad was super tough, and yet I found myself so afraid all the time of having to get involved in physical altercations, and it really bothered me, and I felt like a little bit, you know, insecure and felt like a sense of self-loathing as a teenager that I wasn't as tough as my dad. And I think I sort of probably went too far in writing that and trying to figure out a way to mitigate or like to reduce that level of fear. And so I learned how to fight, and I sort of, I think probably developed a bit of a dickhead tough guy persona in like my teenage years, my early 20s, that took a while for me to catch that I'd become something that I didn't really, that I never wanted to be. It was just a reaction to the situation that I'd found myself in, you know? So
did people, how did bikers react to Jax? I mean, did people try to fight you in public? Or,
you know, bikers specifically, a lot of those dudes are so tough. It's never really the really tough guys that you got to worry about. It's the sort of medium level tough
guys
that fancy themselves being tough but have a lot to prove.
Right.
Those are the dudes that you really got to watch out for. The actual, like, hardcore dudes and, like, real bikers that I interacted with a lot, none of them ever gave me a hard time. They understood that the show was sort of like the Pulp Fiction, like, larger than life representation of their world, and that we weren't trying to actually, you know, really portray them in like a very like you know, just a very like natural, authentic way, you know.
Yeah, so, respectfully.
You know, exactly. Yeah. So
we have another fan from the audience who's gonna ask a question. Where are you? Oh, excellent. You need this microphone? You probably need this. What is your name?
My name's Chloe.
Chloe, what's your question?
I was wondering, what's the craziest thing you've ever done? Ever.
Second to coming on this show. I don't know. I try not to do that. You know what? It's funny. I was actually just about to do the craziest thing that I have ever done, and then it ended up falling through, but I'm going to still do it. But I was supposed to do it last week. There's a friend of mine called Michael Muller, who's an amazing photographer, and he photographed sharks. And he's taken to cage-free diving with the sharks. He just free dives outside of the cage with great whites and everything, you know. I wasn't going with great whites, obviously, but I have an abject terror of the ocean because of sharks. But it's really cool. He's trying to get people that have a little bit of sort of a, like public figures or people that have a little bit of recognition to go out and dive with sharks to show that it's actually fairly safe and to try to change people's perception of sharks. Because, you know, we kill like 100 million sharks a year and the shark populations are in real trouble, you know, and it's very hard to get people excited about shark conservation because they've been through Jaws and all of the other media. The general media relationship with sharks is so vilifying that it's hard to get people to feel sympathetic for the plight. And so I had agreed to go swim with tiger sharks and hammerhead sharks, cage-free. And then, I don't know, I still haven't gotten to the bottom of it. I suspect, because I'm on a big press tour right now, that somebody at the studio thought that that wasn't a great idea, because all of a sudden, this photo shoot that I was supposed to do didn't happen. But at some point in the future, when I'm not under contract, I'm going to go and swim with sharks.
Yeah, my wife had been dying to do it, and we were in the Bahamas, and she was like, "Well, let's go out and we'll get on a boat." And they take you, and you kind of, everyone on the boat sort of shimmies out onto this rope that's tethered to the boat, and then there are sharks swimming below. And the idea is, I mean, you're talking about actually swimming with sharks. We were floating above them. And they go, "Well, they can't swim straight up, you know."
So
I know. That's what I said. I'm like, we're in their fucking living room. What are you talking about? And I don't think I've ever really experienced the feeling before. And I'm just warning you ahead that you might feel, because your body has a very visceral, automatic reaction to, "Oh, I am prey. I am now prey. This thing can murder me in seconds." Right. And I'd never really felt anything like that before. And I immediately shimmied. Of course, my wife was like, "This is the greatest." And I'm like, you know, I shimmied back on the boat. I'm like, "Okay, this was really fun." Have you been swimming with sharks? What's the craziest thing you've ever done?
Oh, I don't think I can say it. So.
Good answer.
I don't know.
Kind of feel like you can.
She's asking the question.
I know, but I'm not sure.
Actually, I think the craziest thing, you guys probably wouldn't consider it that, but I had a kid.
Oh.
Yeah.
That is the craziest adventure life has to offer.
Yeah,
is having well, then I have a very, okay, so knowing you have a child, I have a very special thing for you, which I think this will... You know, your child probably needs to be protected running around. So now your child has a helmet signed by Charlie Hunnam. What is your child's name?
Riley.
That's for Riley. You're welcome. Before we go to break, I want to let you guys know the uncut extended version of this will be available as a Nerdist podcast. If you go to amc.com/talking, you can get bonus clips, exclusive content, and the links to the podcast for every one of our episodes. More with Charlie Hunnam in a moment. We'll see you in a sec. Yeah. Welcome back to Talking with Chris Hardwick. Charlie Hunnam is talking with me, Chris Hardwick. So it's time for me to turn things over again to our live studio audience. Anyone else have a question in the audience they would like to ask? Hello. What is your name?
Hi, I'm Nicole from Santa Clarita.
Hi, nice to see you. What's your question?
Charlie, I just want to say hi. Love your work.
Thank you. You're from Santa Clarita?
Yes. Do you know where that is?
Yeah, we shot there all the time on Suns.
Yes, I know, because I saw you guys on Newhall Ranch Road.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I know. I used to stalk you in Santa Clarita.
Yes, I was that person back there. So, fun fact, actually, my dad sold his bike to the show in the first season, and it was Jax's bike. So my question was...
Is that right?
Yeah. Was what happened to my dad's bike? I've been dying. I never thought I'd be able to ask, so...
It is in my garage.
Is
I stole
it really?
It.
No, it's not.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Are you serious?
No, I stole it.
Oh, my gosh.
along with everything else I could steal at the end of that show, yeah. I figure I'd...
What is your dad's name?
Kevin Diggins.
Oh, my God.
Kevin.
Thank.
Right on, Kevin. Well, thank you for the bike.
That's a good one.
Thank you for the bike, Kevin.
I have a very special...
Yes.
I have a very special...
Oh, my God.
What? Oh,
I'm
gosh.
I'm right here. I'm ready. Can I come this way? And the bike's around the corner, right?
The bike is around the corner. Yeah, we'll get that to you. So you have a very special vest here, and then you have this as well. Of course, you're so welcome. Let's take another question from the audience. Come on up. Come on up. What is your name?
My name's Tova, and I'm from Malibu, California.
Hello.
Charlie, will you sign this shirt for me? It's your actual shirt from Sons of Anarchy. My brother bought it for me. He's a huge prop collector, and I would love for you to sign it for me.
Yes.
This
wow.
is a
you
dream come true. Oh, my God. I'm dying.
Does it still smell?
No. It did. It used to smell really good. Oh, my God.
Do you wear this shirt a lot? Do you wear it a lot?
Well, I didn't wear it
this
for a while.
This was a favorite of mine. This is like season three or four. I used to rock this.
It says Jax in the back. It
yeah, and like felt tip, right?
Yeah. Okay, that was, so here, where should you sign?
Where would you like me to sign?
I'm shaking. I don't know. Right okay, there is fine. Oh, my God. Oh, my. Oh my thank God. You, God.
Oh, my God. That's perfect.
Thank you, God. Oh.
All right, that's how you get out.
Oh, you got a hug.
My pleasure. Is this your pen?
Yeah, it's my pen, and I'm happily married for 20 years. My husband said, just don't embarrass me. I said, okay.
All right.
It sounded like there was a but at the end of I'm happily married for 20 years, but... I mean, is this, you know, the fandom for Sons is so...
Oh, my God,
I mean, the fandom, you know, all these people here, these young ladies sitting in the front row are like, oh, my God, we're so nervous because Charlie's right there. I mean, Sons resonated with people so much. And this is not ordinary fandom with Sons. It's deep.
Yeah.
So when you look back at the series and your experience on the show, like, how do you see it and what's your takeaway from it?
I mean, that interaction that I have with the people that have really loved the show continues, and it's wonderful. I was in Thailand last week, and a lot of the Thai people were coming up, and it has just sort of recently reached the Thai shores. So it seems to be still making its rounds, and people are enjoying it, which is great. You know, I mean, I put everything I have into these projects, so it's really wonderful when some of them work.
But was it hard to say goodbye to him?
It was. It really was. I mean, there was a period... I'd come to love that guy. I'd lived with him in my heart and soul for 8 years, you know, and gotten to know him very well. And in a weird way that sounds sort of a little, you know, airy-fairy and maybe even, like, a little pretentious, but the truth is, like, he, like, became part of me. Like, he was with me the whole time. And there were instances that happened during that period of the show that I feel like behaviorally, I operated differently than I would have either before or after. I got burgled one night. Actually got burgled twice during that period of time. And obviously the sensible thing to do is just to, you know, lock your doors and call the police. But I decided to go fight the dudes both times.
Not advisable.
You know, one time dude was big and it was 3 o'clock in the morning and he was in my yard, you know, and I had a 10-foot fence. So he tried pretty hard to get in there, you know, and I just, you know, Jax took over and just handled the situation, you know. And so it was really hard to say goodbye to him. And, you know, there were a lot of tears and. I found myself really sort of reluctantly letting it go. Although creatively I was ready to say goodbye to that experience and ready to move on and do different things, when it actually came to saying goodbye to Jax, it was much more significant and difficult than I'd anticipated. And I ended up, we shot on the same back lot for the 7 years, and I got very close with the security dudes and all the people that worked around that place. And I, for about 3 or 4 nights after we'd wrapped the show, I found myself getting on my bike and riding out there because I just wanted to sort of still be in that environment and sort of slowly say goodbye to Jax. And the first night I showed up there, the security guys were a bit surprised that I was there because the show had wrapped and there was no reason at all to be there. And I sort of bullshitted them and said I'd forgotten something on the back lawn. And they said, yeah, no problem, just go on. And so I went and hung out for a little while and, you know, may or may not have smoked a joint and just like said like a farewell to Jax. And then the next night I showed up and they were like, you forget something? I was like, yeah, I forgot something else.
I forgot how much I miss you guys.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it was a process to extricate him from my heart, but, you know.
Well, he'll always be with us.
That's right. It was funny, you know, when Opie, when the guy played Opie was written off the show when he ended up leaving, he wrote this amazing essay called The Last Rites of Opie Winston. I never forget, there was one passage in it when he was talking, because that had really blindsided him. He didn't know that his character was going to be... you know, we all assumed that really it was going to be Jax and Opie, like, running the show at the end of the show. And so he really was having a difficult time. And he said this amazing thing that all actors, like carry around this graveyard of characters that they've had to bring to life and then kill. But with Opie, it was the first time that the son of a bitch wouldn't die. And it was like in him, and like he just felt this presence in a way that he'd never had before. And in an act of desperation, he'd found himself in a bookshop, like a performing arts bookshop up on Sunset, I think. And he was looking at all these books on acting, and he said it was so interesting because there were all these books on character development and how to put a character together. And not a single chapter in any of those books how to kill the son of a bitch when you were finished, you know?
Yeah.
It was just really interesting, and I'd seen a few people that had been on that show, because it's a very deep experience for all of us, have real trouble saying goodbye to the experience and to each other. So I knew that I was in for a rough go when we finally had to say goodbye.
I mean, it is kind of like a breakup in a way, because you're
in
a relationship.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it is. It's a bereavement, but you're in a relationship that's just, you know, it's passed away.
Right.
I mean, it's not there anymore, and you don't, you know, I mean, because you're you and you have your face and your body, you can go look in the mirror and go, I'm Jax. But, you know, right. But it's not, but ultimately,
yeah,
you know.
I don't do that that
okay,
often.
All right. Well, I think we all like to imagine that you do. Yeah. But
I did get, like, weird about it. I kept the cut, obviously. I have the cut. I kept everything. I mean, I'm such a pikey. I stole everything I could. I had the rings and the whole getup. I have my knife.
Yeah, I've heard dad's motorcycle.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I've got it all. I would have taken the table, but it wouldn't fit on the back of my bike. But, what was I going to say? Oh, yeah, the cut. And then since that final scene where I took the cut off, I was very, very strict about the fact that nobody could wear it. Like, I have friends, like, hanging in my house, and I have friends be like, oh, let me try that on. And I just decided once I took it off the final time, I was never going to put it back on. And if I wasn't going to put it back on, no one was going to
put it back on.
So.
We have another video message. Let's see. Let's go to the video.
Hey, this is Travis from Tacoma, Washington. And my question for Charlie is, I know you worked with Judd Apatow on Undeclared. What are some of your favorite memories working with him?
Ah, that's a nice question. There really aren't any. Jets are real dickheads. No, I'm joking. No, that was great. It was, you know, the period of time when I did that show, I had just gotten to Los Angeles. Maybe I'd been here for 18 months, but I hadn't developed a core group of friends. And so working with all those young guys, not only did I have a great time with them on the show, but they became my little family in Los Angeles. Jason Segel and Seth Rogen and Jay Baruchel and Tim Sharp and all these people that have gone on to have obviously now enormous careers. But it was great. I mean, it was, I think doing that show and getting and making those friendships is what kept me in LA, because, you know, it was a hard place to settle, and you know, I was pretty unsure. I was unsure whether I was going to make a go of it and make my life here. And it's really meeting those guys that sort of cemented the deal. So,
is comedy something that you ever think you might veer into again?
You know, I think about it sometimes. Comedy's tough, and there's a lot of people out there doing it very well. And my creative pull has always been to the more dramatic stuff, but it is very fun. And I mean, I did have a great time on that show, and I've had fun when I've done comedy in the past. So we'll see. You know, I'm open to all of it.
Whatever happened with the Vlad script that you wrote?
That had many, many ups and downs. We had two different directors attached and wrote many, many drafts of it. And it was just expensive. I mean, like we discussed, I'd wanted to tell the true story of Vlad the Impaler, in which he was the inspiration for Bram Stoker's Dracula. So you can fairly effortlessly weave in all of the mythology that was the man that turned into the myth without actually jumping the shark and making him a vampire.
Right.
But it was very difficult to justify the level of budget that we wanted to, that we really needed to bring that world alive in a really sort of exciting and visceral way. So we pushed the boulder up the hill a few times. It just never quite got it to the top. So, but it's still a story I'd love to tell. So, you know, maybe if keep on, you know, doing well and get some inertia built up.
Well, especially now, you know, there's like limited TV series.
We've had that conversation. I mean, I developed that with Jeremy Kleiner at Plan B, Brad Pitt's company. Mm-hmm. He actually produced also The Lost City of Zed that I did, and I have another project with him that we've been developing. And we've been talking about that, the potential of doing it as a limited series. It might be pretty cool.
Brad Pitt's company is called Plan B. He named his company after the morning after pill?
Yeah. Yeah.
Take a second for that.
You know, when you're that handsome.
Hey, come on. It's always Plan B somewhere, am I right, guys? It's always Plan B somewhere. Yeah, I think it'd be really interesting. I wonder if there was a network that we were on right now that was good with genre programming that might do a Vlad the Impaler show. AMC! No. Yeah, I'm talking about you. We have time for one more question, I believe. One more fan question. Hey, what's your name?
Hi, Gina from Los Angeles.
And what's your question?
What was it like shooting in the jungle for Lost City of Z?
It was wonderful. I mean, it was really, really wonderful. It's amazing to be. I mean, I think we all live in cities, right? Where most you'll see of the natural world is going to a park and seeing a tree with a couple birds in it. So to be somewhere that was so vital and like filled with life, and you know, we all with climate change and overpopulation, and everything, I think, have a tendency to get very neurotic and upset about the state of the world. And it was really reassuring and exciting to be somewhere that was so filled with life. But obviously it had its downsides too, because some of that life wants to kill you. I had a rather unpleasant interaction with a beetle that burrowed its way into my ear while I was sleeping and got in, but
didn't... Are you fucking kidding? That's the bug. Oh, God.
Yeah, man. It got in, but then it couldn't get back out.
Oh, God.
It had never had to walk backwards before, and it wasn't sure.
And you were
exactly
worried about shaking a sweaty guy's hand, and you had a fucking beetle burrowing in your brain?
Dude, so it got there, and it hit the eardrum, and it couldn't go any further, and it panicked. So it just thought it would bite, it's chew its way through.
Oh, God!
So it bit a hole in my eardrum. So I woke up to this sort of pneumatic, what sounded like a pneumatic drill in my ear as it was like burrowing around, panicking. And I had one of the, we were working 6 days a week, and it was our day off the next day, and I didn't want to bother anyone. But we were in the middle of the jungle, the middle of nowhere. So I had one of those, you know, like irrigation pots, yeah. Like water irrigation pots, like a neti pot. And I just filled it up with water and stuck it in my ear and tried to, like, you know, flush him out. And nothing came out, but he stopped moving. So I thought, all right, this is going to be okay. So I went back to bed.
What? Still a beetle in your head.
I work hard. I was tired. So I went back to sleep, and I woke up the next morning, and it was moving around again. I said, oh, man, we're going to have to do something about this. So I called production, and they called an ambulance. And an ambulance came to the hotel, but the medic didn't speak any English. And so she brought the receptionist of the hotel with her. So she came and put the instrument in my ear and had a little look around. And then I was just, like, trying to make eye contact with her to discern what actually was happening. She didn't look to me. She looked at the receptionist in the hotel and went and handed him the scope. And then he had a look in my ear, and I thought, all right, this is probably the point where we go to hospital because this is not...
they pulled the beetle out?
Yeah, they had to flush it out, and it was...
Did you keep it?
No, it was a very sad story for me and the beetle. You know, the pump that they use to irrigate out the ear canal is very powerful, so the beetle sort of disintegrates.
Good, fuck that guy. Fuck him. Seriously,
bad, honestly,
how dare you crawl
into your ear? I wanted to figure out a way to get him out alive, but I thought maybe we could have made friends.
Oh, my God. That is one of the most horrifying things I've ever... Oh, God. I'm going to have nightmares about that. I do...
It's funny. I had a girlfriend years ago, and a moth flew into her ear.
Yeah,
and she completely panicked and wigged out, and was literally like running around the living room like a mad person, screaming and slapping her ear.
You sure the moth wasn't just driving her brain?
Right,
just staring at the light.
But I had to grab her, and I grabbed her. I mean, this is, I don't know, maybe too much information. And pinned her to our bed, and got some tweezers and pulled it out. Oh. And so I'd sort of already gone through that procedure before, so that
okay, good.
I was able to
So if you ever get a bug in your ear, Charlie Hunnam's your guy. I have a present for you.
So we have a bug for you.
Do you want a shield or gauntlets?
Gauntlets.
Gauntlets. All right. Here you go. Here are your... Here, hold your hand out. Yeah, there you go. Get that in there. And then get this in here. Great, I will take that for you. Never take those off the rest of your life. Just a couple more quick things before we let you go. What's going on with Pac Rim 2? Is there a Pac Rim 2? Are you doing a Pac Rim 2?
There is a Pac Rim 2. I was not available. I was shooting something else.
Got it.
I had a very finite amount of time,
sure.
So I am not doing it.
Okay, but, gotcha.
You might just pop up. Tiny little appearance. We'll see.
Just some rapid fire questions before we let you go. Joan Sooks on Twitter. Is there an actor with whom you feel you've been chasing the same roles?
Oh, wow. Yeah, through like the different stages of my career, there have been several. There was a rather annoying period of time where Justin Timberlake... like two, maybe even three roles in a row that I had wanted. So
really?
You better watch out, Justin.
Let's see if you're going to... Lady Bonus, it's a reaction... I just want to see if there's any good questions. Any quick questions before we... Oh, Wendy Mac 27, are you interested in directing or producing in the future?
Yes, I am currently already producing. I have three projects that I'm developing as a producer that are things for me to star in as an actor. And then I have a film that I've been doing a tremendous job procrastinating, actually sitting down to write, that I would like to direct myself, a tiny, tiny little independent film.
Is there anything you can tell us about any of those?
The film that I want to direct is a little love story set against the backdrop of the gypsy community in the north of England.
Cool. Great. So. Does it have a title? Do you have a title for you?
No.
All right.
Up to suggestions. Suggestions. If you...
Call it Bug in My Ear.
Okay. Working title.
Working title. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so we got that. Biggest favorite movie, TV shows? Eh, that's all right. What's your? Oh, you know what? I'm kind of curious. The Real Negan on Instagram wants to know what's your favorite movie.
Oof, that's an impossible one. I really don't have a favorite movie. What have I been watching a lot recently? This is one of those blank things where it's basically all I think about and all I spend every second of my day doing is watching movies, and then I ask a question like this.
And you don't, you can't think of what, yeah, I know. It's too big of a, it's like going to Google and going, I can find out anything I want.
Oh, what do I want to know?
Oh, I could learn anything.
You know who's the safe? Godfather 2 is always a safe one to throw out there.
Yeah, good. Excellent. And then Hodges Art, the defining question, Star Wars or Star Trek?
Star Wars.
Star Wars. All right. There we go. Excellent. One of the things that we've kind of been doing at the end of the show is because, you know, one of the reasons why I started the podcast was just to, I just wanted to learn about people. I wanted to learn, as I sort of feel like, I don't really know what I'm doing. How do other people figure out what they want to do? How do other people figure? This has all just been an incredible learning experience for me. I always love to get just nuggets of wisdom from people. So I guess, is there any piece of life advice or is there some sort of guiding principle that, you know, sort of you take with you everywhere that keeps your head above water and keeps you sane? Like, what's something that you, I mean, you said the Thoreau quote earlier, but is there anything else that you leave?
I don't know if it's great advice because it's a double-edged sword. It both motivates me and also creates an enormous amount of anxiety. But I think that the defining obsession of my life so far has been the judicious use of time, just recognizing how precious time is and trying to make the most of it every day, like wake up and, you know, and you know, we all have our responsibilities, financial and responsibilities to family, but to try to carve out as much time every day to bring forth who you want to be and what you want to do with your life.
Excellent. This was amazing. Thank you so much, Charlie Hunnam, for being here. King Arthur, Legend of the Sword is in theaters May 12th. Also remember to check out @talk on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter to find out who's going to be on the show and how you can be a part of it. And when is the other film coming out? Do you know yet? We don't know yet.
Yeah, we do know. I should know. I'll get back to you.
Brandon,
that.
Do we know? Do we know? Can
it's
we find out?
April 15th? Why not? You know, it comes out different places.
Oh, it comes out. You know what? I think it's already come out by the time this airs. That's what it is.
Uh-huh.
That it has already been out. Anyway, the movie did great. Yeah.
Thank
it was
you.
Great. Well
thank
done. Charlie Hunnam, everyone. Thank you so much. I'm Chris. Be nice to each other. Don't text and drive. And I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.